You are listening to the cycling podcast Femina, supported by Rafa, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004.
Where are we, Orla, to paraphrase a famous cycling podcast?
Famous. We are in Leeds City Centre on our way to Waterstones to host Lizzie Deignan's book launch.
It actually says Lizzie Armitstead on the cover of the book. You notice that?
It does, actually. That's going to be confusing all night, but we know who she is. Lizzie Deignan Armitstead.
Yeah, her book's just been published. It's an interesting book. It opens with the events of last year when she had the possibility of a two-year suspension hanging over her head in the run-up to the Rio Olympic Games, won her appeal at the Court of Arbitration for Sport. There's some detail in the book that we didn't previously know about that and about what happened there. We'll ask her about that, obviously. This is an event in front of an audience, so we'll chat to her for a bit and then we'll take some questions from the audience. Anything you're particularly looking forward to asking her, Orla?
And I don't want it to sound too obvious, but the sections of her book that I found the most interesting is where she addressed sexism in cycling and the really quite shocking discrepancy between how the female athletes in British cycling were treated and have been treated compared to the men and the support given to the men's squad in comparison to the women. Even for someone like me who's been following British cycling two races for, 10 years, I hadn't realised the extent to which there was such inequality between the two. So she's really good talking about those issues and a good few anecdotes from that as well. So we'll hopefully get that out of her tonight.
Right, well, let's head in. Sorry if we sounded a bit distracted there. We were squeezing through some scaffolding. It's raining, so we're brawled up. And now we're looking for Watson's. Where is it, Orla? I was sure it's around this corner. But anyway, we'll find it and we'll go in and we'll do this event. You'll hear it in a moment. And then we'll come back afterwards and do a little bit of a debrief. We'll also hear then from William Fotheringham, the journalist and author who collaborated with Lizzie on her book. And it's quite interesting to get his perspective on that process and his assessment of her, really, as well. It's quite interesting. So we'll hear from William as well. So we'll be back afterwards, but in the meantime, here we are with Lizzie Deignan.
So we're here, obviously, discussing your book, and it starts with, for anyone who hasn't read it yet, it starts with events that led up to Rio 2016 last year, and the circumstances surrounding your temporary suspension from sport. I'll ask you about that in just a moment, but first of all, what's it been like to, I guess, finally get the chance to tell your side of the story, because you wanted to tell it on your terms and in your way, and here we are almost a year later, I guess, three quarters of a year later, talking about it. Has that been good for you? How have you found the reaction to that?
I suppose I've not really looked into the reaction too much. That's something I've learned since last summer. Unfortunately, I don't look at a lot of feedback like I used to. It's probably a shame, because I'm sure I miss a lot of positive feedback, but it's something that I've chosen to kind of avoid, really. But in terms of how it's made me feel, it's been really good to get it all down on paper, because even in an interview, a short interview, it's very difficult to put across just the complexity of the whereabouts system. You can't really explain it in a 2-minute interview, so it's been good to be able to put it all in context, and even for myself, because it was quite a traumatic week, you know, it was all condensed into a week, so to be able for myself to kind of put it all in a logical order and know exactly what happened and where it happened, rather than just this kind of big mess cloud that I had surrounding that week, it's been good.
Talk us through that week then, if you don't mind.
It took about 5 hours and I was cleared unanimously by the Court of Arbitration for Sport. A very quick case, kind of unprecedented how quickly it happened. And from there, I went home, had a nice evening where I was like, okay, you know, the weight of the world was gone and I could finally focus on the games. And then I think it was the Monday or the Tuesday that the Daily Mail leaked the story. And from then it was just a blaze of kind of one fire breaking out after another and just kind of getting through it, and traveled to Rio got off the plane in Rio and suddenly there was paparazzi there for me and not Bradley Wiggins and Cavendish. It was a bit weird, kind of hustled into this dark van and to the team hotel. And yeah, then I did the race and got the fifth place. So it wasn't the Rio I'd been dreaming of for 4 years, but I got through it.
Talk about your time when you arrived in Rio. And myself and Jill Douglas both did interviews with you then. I've interviewed you a lot over the years, and you're always someone who comes across, at least, as very confident, very self-assured, and I guess quite certain of your place in the world. And I saw a very different person. And for me, that was actually, I found it quite a difficult interview because it was seeing how raw the emotions were with you. You just came across as someone so vulnerable. How difficult was that whole period? I mean, you'd built up to that for 4 years. You were world champion, one of the favourites. And to have all of that negativity around you, what was that like?
Very difficult to deal with, yeah. As a professional athlete, I'm used to criticism of my performance, but that was really very personal and it felt quite vicious at the time. Obviously, I was in that bubble, so I probably didn't have a greater perspective on it like the people outside, but from my perspective, it was just like a barrage of attacks, and I had no defense really in that situation because it was just the timing was just so intense. And I felt very vulnerable. I just kind of thought, right, let's get the race done and get out of here.
You say that, you know, Court of Arbitration did reject the case made by UCAD. Why do you think they went after you in the way that they did?
I don't know, and I still don't know. And I find it very strange that, you know, they test me so much. I'm one of the most tested athletes there is, and they must know that I'm a clean athlete. And I found it quite bizarre that even in the media, with what was happening to me, that at no point did UK Anti-Doping stand up and say, you know, we're an organisation who are solely aimed at looking after clean athletes. I'm an individual trying to do my best, and I made some mistakes, but they made some mistakes. And if the process is to be trusted, then surely they also have to stick their hands up and say, you know, sorry, we made a mistake. But they didn't do that at any point. And that was hard to take because that could have helped me out big time, you know.
There's a lot in the press at the moment about whether professional sport, elite sport, maybe pushes people too hard. You know, you talk about sport being fun and a very positive thing. How do you reconcile it? Because what comes across in the book as well is how seriously you took it very early. I mean, there's descriptions of you, you know, when you just discovered that you had a talent for cycling, you set about it in a quite an organized way. You describe a sort of disorganized organization. You describe turbo training in the garage with listening to music and doing like a song on, song off, you know, an effort for a song and then taking a rest. Now that it sounds sort of ad hoc, but that's actually quite structured.
Yeah, well, I started cycling in an environment with British Cycling where it was all very performance focused. It was never a hobby for me. I started cycling at 15 on a talent program, which was all about government funding and medals. So for me, it was a career path. It was like my friends were going to uni or getting a job, and this presented itself to me as a career choice. So I took it quite seriously in that way, and I've always seen it as a job.
And yet, one that you clearly enjoy.
Yeah, I've grown to enjoy it, though. I didn't enjoy it that much in the beginning. It's a tough sport, but it kind of takes quite a long time to get to know the ins and outs of it, the language around it. If you come from a family that's never raced bikes, then it's almost like a different language. And I suppose the more I've learned, the more I've come to love it, yeah.
One of the things that really struck me was how you seem to, initially in your career, be quite accepting of maybe a second place or a third place. The World Championships in Richmond in 2015, the first time maybe that you really properly targeted and planned for a win. Tell us about the change in mentality that took and bravery, I guess, to put that on the line.
I always look at Olympians and I always think, wow, you know, they're these kind of special species of human. And always thought that I didn't really belong in that category. And then I suppose with age and with experience, I realized that these podiums could turn into wins if I actually just believed in myself more and had a bit more confidence. So going in to Ponferrada the year before Richmond, that World Championships, I had a real chance of winning, but I didn't plan it to perfection. And I realized that if I could do that in Richmond, then I'd have a good chance of becoming world champion, because the effort and the sacrifice is the same. So you might as well add in the confidence and get the rainbow.
It really struck me as well, and I find it actually quite shocking. In Richmond, in Ponferrada, in Copenhagen as well, the year that Mark Cavendish won, the huge disparity between the amount of support that the men's team got compared to you, and compared to the women's team, actually. And if we look at the women's team, who had a credible option in the form of Nicole Cook for years before you came along, there's always been a possible world champion in the women's ranks and not always in the men's. What's that been like, and in what way did that translate into reality?
I've always seen it as my responsibility to be ready on the day for the World Championships. Rather than kind of look at what I'm missing from British cycling, I've always thought, well, where else can I get it? And I found that with Bols Dolmans. They give me incredible support. But at the World Championships in Richmond, yeah, they did let me down. They've since acknowledged that and apologised for it and have put things in place to prevent that happening again. But on the day of Richmond, yeah, the coach that was meant to be looking after me was with the junior men. And, you know, that certainly didn't happen to Mark Cavendish on the day in Copenhagen when he was favourite for the world title. So there was massive discrepancies, and, you know, I've challenged that and I will always challenge that, and hopefully this year it'll be better.
I mean, describe, if you don't mind, because it's in the book and the detail is astonishing and really eye-opening. The build-up, well, you talk about London as well, and you know, the fact that the men in London were all on specially made UK Institute of Sport bikes, I think they were, and you know, you had to buy your own electric gears and lots of other things that you had to take care of yourself, where, you know, the men were provided for. But in Richmond, where you became world champion, the build-up to that, in terms of the famous sort of British cycling attention to detail, seemed to be lacking a little bit, from everything from the food to the tire pressure.
Yeah, it was a time when British cycling staff all seemed to be moving around, so there was nobody allocated to us. So Brian Stevens was put in charge of the women's team, I think in the February, into the women's peloton. He had no idea who anybody was in terms of being able to select the team, you know, no knowledge of women's cycling. And unfortunately, in Richmond, I'd prepared, like I said, every minute detail so that when I moved into the Great Britain Cycling Team Hotel, that really nothing needed to be done except, you know, pumping up my tyres on the day. And small details like that sound ridiculous, but it was a cobbled course, it was potentially raining, it was potentially dry, and I knew exactly what tyre pressure I needed in each situation. And, you know, I got to the start of the race and the team camper was locked. There wasn't a member of staff anywhere. My tyres were soft, and, you know, all these small details that can really add to a world title were just not there.
You have an interesting relationship with Nicole Cook. You don't seem to be friends, yet when you emerged as one of the top riders, she was, and going further back, she was somebody you clearly admired, and your experiences with her don't seem to have been that positive. And yet, there's something that you seem to have learned from her and even admire about her, and it's that ruthlessness that Orla mentioned.
Yeah, she's tenacious, and when she wants something, she goes and she gets it, and that's obviously something that I would respect.
Yeah, it's been at your expense at times.
Yeah, definitely. When she was coming off her peak and I was coming up, there was that kind of couple of years there where I'd hoped that she'd work for me at a World Championships. But she was phenomenal, and she had an incredible career where she won so many races. And of course, for any athlete to kind of step back and probably, you know, look in the mirror and think maybe this young girl coming up has better chance than me is a difficult thing to deal with. And it didn't go smoothly. But it's never something that I've wanted to be too negative about, because, like I say, she was a phenomenal athlete and I have a huge amount of respect for her.
And is it fair to say that you did learn something from her? I mean, I think Commonwealth Games road race, is it Commonwealth Games road race where Emma Pooley was up the road?
Yeah.
Teammate, and she attacked and she was off the front. And there was a moment in the race there where you felt it was yours and that you were going to take it regardless. Was that, I mean, can you link that directly to lessons that you learned perhaps from Nicole Cook?
I suppose I've never considered it, but yeah, I have looked at other athletes, Nicole Cook included, and realised that it does come down to killer instinct at some point. And although it doesn't come naturally for me, I need to make sure that on those days where I am focused on an event, that I bring that to the race.
Where do you think we are these days with sexism in women's cycling, or is that too big a question?
No, we're getting there. We're not anywhere near where we need to be, but I think the positive thing is that sexism within our sport can no longer grow. It's not something that can grow in the sport anymore because it's constantly challenged. So although we're not where we need to be, I think there are steps each season that I've seen that are positive, and we will get there.
Do you mind telling us about the incident with the birthday party and the dancing incident that you mentioned? And I guess as a follow-on, whether you think that kind of thing would happen today?
So that story in the book is when I was riding for Garmin Cervelo, and there was a birthday party in the hotel, one of the male riders' birthdays. And I had gone to bed in my own room, went to sleep. There was a knock on the door. It was a female member of staff, and she wanted me to go downstairs to join the party. So I went downstairs, joined the party, which was unusual for me because I was like, aren't we meant to sleep and like be professional? But it was new for me. I was new on the road and I thought, okay, I'll do it. And I went downstairs and it was basically a dance game. And I had to dance next to the birthday boy on the Wii, and all the men in the room were watching. And once I was done, I was allowed to go back to bed. And at that time, I didn't sort of analyze it or understand it properly. I just thought, okay, it was a bit of fun. But when I spoke to William Fotheringham about the book and we went through the stories, he saw it as quite a dark thing. And I thought, well, I never felt vulnerable or intimidated, but looking back on it, I realized that the key thing was that I just wasn't taken seriously. And at that age, I didn't realize that, but looking back, I realized that I wouldn't let it happen now.
And sexism in sport, in cycling in particular, is something that you've been vocal about. You addressed it in your post London 2012 press conference. And in the book, you say that one journalist described you as a reluctant campaigner, and you didn't want to be described as reluctant, even though you're not necessarily always wanting to talk about it. How would you describe that campaigning side of it, if even that's the right description?
It's just frustrating that after a bike race, I have to talk about being a woman all the time. Not being a bike rider, I'm like, I just won a massive race and you're asking me again, like, how is women cycling? And it's just frustrating. And that's the reluctant part of it. But I understand that that is my responsibility as somebody who has a voice. And, I've been brought up to challenge things when they're not right. So I have to, do it reluctantly. But it is something. Oh, sorry. There's the frustration.
Getting annoyed. Bringing the house down. Yeah. Is that something you say quite rightly, that after a race you want to talk about the race and not about whether it was a woman's race or not? You happen to be a woman. Is that something that you think is specific to cycling, or is that the world that we unfortunately live in? Do you see, or do you pay attention to other sports and notice it there?
Yeah, I think as successful sportswomen, it's something that you constantly have to answer. If you look at somebody like Serena Williams, it's something that she's constantly fighting for. So hopefully in 10 years time, or however long it takes, it will start to filter through, and we'll be in a society where, there is more equal opportunities for women in sport.
This sort of links to the sexism question as well, I suppose. You talk about, as a female athlete, there are some female athletes who seem equally concerned with image and with playing that game as with performance and results. And that's, you can do both, of course. You've sort of chosen not to, you know. How do you feel about that? Because on the one, I mean, Marla and I had a long conversation about this on the train on the way here. It's sort of unique, not entirely unique, but it is pretty unique to female athletes. And how do you, why don't you go down the road of becoming not only a great cyclist, but also somebody whose image is out there and who's well known as a face as well as a rider?
Because it's about being taken seriously. It's about my athletic performance, and I want to impress people with the power in my legs, not with a selfie or a touched up image in whatever magazine. It's just not who I am. It never has been, and it's never tempted me. Even the sort of the fame aspect of it is something that kind of has come with it, with cycling success. It's not something that I've chased. You know, I don't do it to be in a magazine. I do it because I love cycling, I love sport, and the other stuff is kind of a bit that comes with it.
And do you still love it as much? I mean, your performances so far this year suggest that you've been working hard at it. But this, regardless of how people get on in Olympics, post-Olympic year is always very hard, or often very hard, for athletes to pick themselves up and work as hard as they did, you know, to get to the Olympics in the first place. How has that been for you post-Rio? And what's sort of motivating you at the moment this year in particular?
December and January, definitely I struggled. Because you know what you put into it the year before. Last season, I did everything. I was so focused and I worked so hard, and I thought, how can I possibly replicate that again? How can I be as, you know, I was almost scared of who I was the year before. But then, you know, your performance drops and you feel rubbish on the climbs, and that's not nice either. And you think, well, I'm doing this anyway. I'm living away from my family. I'm not seeing my friends. I might as well give this 100%. And I suppose it's always conscientiousness that carries me through. It is my job, and I do represent my sponsors. And I suppose I'd just feel too lazy if I didn't give it 100%. You know, you feel rubbish. It's like an amateur does if they don't go out on a Saturday and they've said to themselves that they would. It's the same feeling as a professional.
I spoke recently to William Fullingham, who you worked with on the book, and I asked him for his impressions of you as an athlete. And he's obviously written books with and about other riders, and he described you as a ticker offer rather than a collector. You know, if you look at someone like Eddie Merckx, was the cannibal. He would gobble up as many races as he could, whereas someone like Bradley Wiggins would set his sights on a goal, achieve it, move on to something else. He thinks you're more like that. Is that how you see yourself as well?
Yes, I think I'm more of a ticker offer. Yeah. Just because it takes so much to achieve a goal, that to do it again for the same outcome doesn't give me the same hunger. Definitely not.
So what Orla mentioned that you were particularly keen, I think, to try and win the races that have just past us. Do they remain therefore on your wish list for next year? Or, you know, what's driving you this year?
I suppose it's a bonus that I didn't win, yeah, because I still got goals next year. The national championships is always important to me, mainly because my least favorite color is orange, but but to wear the national stripes in Europe is a sense of pride, and to be announced as a British champion every time you race is really special. The World Championships in Norway, I know I've ticked that box of becoming world champion, but I really want to win it for a second time to know how to appreciate it more, if that makes sense. The first time, you don't really know what to expect. You're just thrown into this kind of busy schedule, just mess, and I'd love to be able to win it again and just appreciate it.
Would you plan your celebration this time around?
Yeah, I'd get my hands in the air this time, yeah.
And also after that, you said after your world celebration, or for your world celebration, you took the girls out for tequila, was it?
Yeah.
And you miscalculated. You bought 25 tequila shots for 6 riders. That's quite a miscalculation, Lizzie.
Yeah, and we'd not eaten much before we went. I had a Nutella sandwich after the race, and yeah, we went out, had some tequilas, and we even had oysters. Like, some bloke bought us some oysters as a celebration, and they were horrible. And yeah, it was an early night.
Nutella sandwich, oysters, and tequila.
Yeah.
Brilliant. What about the Olympics then? 2020, it's still quite a way off. The tone of your book suggests that you're maybe closer to retirement than not. Would we see you, do you think, competing in Tokyo?
I mean, I'll never say never. 4 years passes very quickly, but I'd always envisage actually retiring after 2018, and then Yorkshire went and got the World Championships, so looks like I'm going to have to keep on riding until that, at least. I think it, you know, I say it's just one race, and it would, you know, a year's a long time just for one race, but to be sat on the sidelines watching the World Championships through Yorkshire, I think would be too difficult.
And then it's only a year until the Olympics. So it goes on.
I know, yeah. But I think that's where you have to be steadfast in your decisions and make your own decisions. And my career will finish when I want it to, not when anybody else wants it to.
Nevertheless, as a ticker offer, you know, the Olympic Games, the gold medal there was obviously a huge ambition for you to not have done it and to actually have gone pretty close on the day. I mean, people forget that despite your build-up to the race, and I think you say in the book how determined you were. You had a puncture early on as well. How determined you were in the race to not give up and not give perhaps people the sight some of them wanted of you quitting the race. You finished fifth, I think, didn't you?
I did.
So how much does that nag away at you? Is that a disappointment that you weren't able to do there what you wanted to do?
It's difficult to be objective about what I would have been able to do. Because it was a course that didn't particularly suit me. And I think I rode extremely well there. I'm proud of the performance that I was able to do. But I had 2 months of, you know, not much sleep going into it. So I don't know what I was capable of, really, if everything had gone well. But that's sport, isn't it? You have to learn to deal with defeat as well as victory. And there's so many incredible champions who never become world champion in their career. And I've ticked off a lot of boxes, and if, you know, silver medal at the Olympics is as close as I'll get to an Olympic gold, then I think I can handle that.
You spoke earlier about your relationship with Nicole Cook and how, you know, you were coming up as she was on the decline. In Richmond especially, you were riding with a very young British team, and there are some young British riders who are coming through and might begin to snap at your heels a little bit. Do you think you will behave with them in a different way? I mean, do you, it seems that apart from taking them out and getting them drunk on tequila, you had quite a sort of sense of responsibility towards them, and you were very keen to sit down with them a lot and help them. At some point, some of them will maybe start to challenge you. How do you think you will feel, and how will you react in that situation?
Well, I talk about in the book, in Qatar, for instance, at the end of this last season, I went in as defending champion, but the team meeting, I didn't ask for any help, because that was a race where anybody could win it, and any one of those girls could have had the opportunity to win it. You know, I wasn't particularly motivated or in top form at that time. It was a long season and I was pretty knackered. I was there to try and, you know, almost out of respect for the champion after me, and I certainly didn't ask any of the girls to support me in that race. I gave them the opportunity to go out there and do what they could. So I think, yeah, I will handle it differently.
Any chance of going back to the track?
I'd love to race the track, but whether I could hack it when riding around in circles in Manchester, you know, I'm not sure. It's not like any other nation. You know, the Great Britain cycling team on the track is the strongest in the world. You don't just walk into a team like that. You have to commit to it. You can't combine the road and the track, and I just love the road too much.
You weren't, I mean, you've been not too involved with British cycling for the last few years, but some of the stories, the headlines over the last year in particular about the culture there, the picture that's been painted, is that one that you recognise from your experiences there, from what you hear about riders, you know, that you're still friends with who are part of that?
I think it's really unfair that a headline can state British cycling is sexist. I mean, British cycling is an umbrella for hundreds of people who work there, hundreds of dedicated and committed people who've sacrificed an awful lot to put cycling where it is now, and it's not fair at all for that headline to be branded about so easily. Obviously, if somebody feels that they've been a victim of bullying or sexism, then they should be taken seriously. But it's not a personal experience that I've had.
I mentioned earlier that, you know, that some of the harsh realities of professional sport, you know, and you talk about the need for frankness, for honesty, and, you know, how some people, male or female, just aren't maybe cut out for that environment. That is a difficult balance to strike, isn't it? And it's easy to see why some people who have bad experiences might interpret them in a, I guess, a certain way.
I think the way to differentiate is whether it's professional or whether it's personal. And if it's personal, then that obviously has to be taken seriously and reviewed. But in my case, it was always ruthless, but it was always professional.
But there's an overlap, isn't there? You mentioned the book about, you know, you will be told as an athlete, male or female, that you might be too fat, for example. That's something that, if it's applied to a female athlete, can sometimes be interpreted as and presented as sexist. And you're saying in the book, a coach has got to be able to say that to an athlete.
Yeah, in my view, yeah. If it's affecting your performance, whether it's your weight or your attitude or whatever, then you have to be told that. That's elite sport. You know, we're not here to kind of take part. It is about medals, and the funding does come from medals and gold ones at that.
Shall we open up for questions now? A few hands going up. We'll pass this microphone around, I think, won't we?
Hi. Bradley Wiggins said of you in September 2016, he said reasons you gave for missing the drug tests were, I'll quote them here, ludicrous and ridiculous, and he said there's no excuse for missing the drugs tests. How do you feel about that, especially considering what's emerged about Bradley Wiggins with the TUE since then?
That's a very professional question. I've said it before and I'll say it again. I have no interest in, you know, a tit for tat with Bradley Wiggins. If his choice is to say things like that about me, then that's his choice, but I'm certainly not going to retaliate in a way to detriment him. My stance on TUEs is that I've never had one, and the responsibility to talk about Bradley Wiggins' TUEs lies with him and not with me.
How come you haven't been wearing your signature pearl earrings in the recent races?
Well, good question. Honestly, I lost the back off one of them, and they were real pearls that my husband bought me, so I thought I'd better look after them properly. I always used to wear some that I got from Sainsbury's. Yeah, once I met my husband, he told me that I should be wearing real pearls. And safely, they're in a drawer.
You say that women's sport, or women's cycling, has grown hugely since you started. Where do you sit on the view of new women's races being women's versions of the men's races, or new independent women's races being the best way to go?
I'm asked this question a lot, and I think, what's wrong with both? You know, if there's a men's race that's already got the crowds there, that's already got the history and the interest, and we put on a women's race next to it, then that's great, because we're able to showcase to those cycling fans who hopefully like cycling that women's cycling isn't that different, and you know, we kind of grab that audience while it's there. But also the women's tour, for instance, in the UK, independent women's race, is successful on its own. So I think there's a place for both. I don't think we need to separate.
I think we're all, I think I speak for everybody when I say we're all really pleased that you're here tonight, but do you not think it's Tuesday evening? You should be out on the chain gang.
Not in this weather. Yeah, the chain gang, for anyone who's not been, is a pretty ruthless training ride, but it's always good to go and give the men a kicking.
The cycling podcast Femina is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
So Orla, that was Lizzie Dagnan. We were in conversation with her in Watterson's in Leeds. She was launching her new book. Should say before we dissect a bit of that, thank you very much indeed to Science in Sport for sponsoring the cycling podcast Femina, as indeed they sponsor the cycling podcast. Very grateful to them for their support. And you, the listener, can get 20% off all Science and Sport products at scienceandsport.com if at the checkout you enter the code CPOD20. CPOD20. So Lizzie Dagnan, I mean, we're going to hear a little bit from William Fotheringham, who worked with her on her book. She's always a very interesting person to speak to. We should point out, and obviously everybody who's listened, but an event like that with an audience is very different to an interview. You ask different questions, and it's just different, isn't it? But nevertheless, you know, she is one of these very interesting people. In fact, it was an interview with Lizzie Armitstead, as she was then, that really was the catalyst for this podcast, the podcast Femina, because I think we broadcast it end of February last year, and it got a terrific response and a huge audience, and it made us realise that there was an appetite out there for stories about women cycling and about women cyclists. And she is one of the more, well, she's very thoughtful, isn't she?
She is, and she's very candid. And I think it's always slightly disarming with Lizzie Dagnan because she has quite a gentle manner about her and such an engaging smile that you almost expect whatever comes out of her mouth to be quite sweet and sugar-coated, and it rarely is. And I think it always makes for an interesting chat with her because she does speak very frankly and she does consider things an awful lot. And that comes across in the book as well. It's quite it's quite a measured book. You know, there isn't much frivolity to her. She's thought an awful lot about how she lives her life and about how she approaches her career and everything that comes with that, the fame aspect, the social media aspect. And it makes her a very interesting voice on sexism in cycling as well. And there are a few incidents that she references in the book that we spoke about in the talk. And it was lovely as well to see her in the environment that she was in tonight, because we're sitting, at the moment we're in a bar, a burger joint in central Leeds, and we're only about 10 miles away from where she grew up in Otley. So it was a very favourable audience, if you like, friends and family and whatnot, and little girl sitting in the front row from the Otley Cycle Club, which was really sweet. And it's lovely to see that with all of fame that she has garnered in international sports, certainly in cycling, and all the accolades that she has won, it's really lovely to see how supported she is by her local community, because community is something, and family and friends are something that come out really strongly in the book, is something that she says that matter more to her than her sport. So it was strange to see her in this environment, really. And she said before going out that she felt a little bit uneasy, really, because her parents were there and she feels uncomfortable talking about herself. She doesn't necessarily like that spotlight on her, but it was a lovely event.
She is, the interview I did with her last year as well, sometimes she gives the impression of being slightly awkward and uncomfortable and guarded, which can make you as the person speaking to her feel awkward, and you come away and listen to what she said, and it's actually really interesting. Somebody who's got to know her very well over the last year or so and worked with her closely on her book is the journalist and author William Fotheringham. And I spoke to him recently about what that experience was like, how the process was, and he had some interesting impressions of Lizzie Dagnan. Here is William Fotheringham.
William, you worked with Lizzie Armitstead on her autobiography. I guess for a lot of us, she's a bit of an enigma. She's somebody who kind of feel that we know and don't know at the same time. Did you manage to, in working with her, crack that enigma?
No, I don't think so, to be honest. I think you have to work with Lizzie for a long time before you crack that enigma. I think, as you know, as ghostwriter and person being ghosty, if you like, you don't break that barrier on, you know, very quickly. I think you've either got a close relationship already on the back of which you ghostwrite a book, or you ghostwrite a book and you see how the relationship develops. But we came to the book relatively cold, in the sense that, you know, we'd had quite a lot of contact, but what I realised was actually most of that was by phone. I don't think we'd ever sat down face to face and done an interview, because interestingly, you know, from my point of view professionally, I could always get what I needed by working on the telephone, and you know, from her point of view, she could do what she had to do in terms of working with me before we did the book, obviously, you know, again, without, you know, without working face to face. That was quite an interesting thing, actually.
I mean, in interviews with her, she's one of these very rewarding interviewee, in that she gives very interesting answers, but yeah, she's also at the same time guarded. There's a certain point where the shutters come down, and yeah, and she stops, and you have to come up with the next question. And I guess the impression that you have based on those exchanges, those experiences, is that she's in control, very in control. To work with her on a book means taking things a step further. She has to open up a little bit more. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, that is true. But I mean, what was interesting about working on the book was that she was more involved than other people I've worked on books with, and she was involved in a very good way. She was very interested in the whole process. She, you know, the cliche is that, you know, as a ghostwriter, you sit down and you'll give, you know, you do an interview and then you go away, and then the next time your ghostie looks at it is, you know, when it turns up as a page proof, and they go, yes, fine, send it away. That's the cliche. I'm not saying it's like that, but that is the cliched view. But you know, what interested me was that she did take in it. You know, she took a lot of interest in A, how I was going to do it, you know, and B, you know, when the book was actually being written, she took quite a lead role in what I call the creative process, you know, which was very rewarding as a writer. You know, as writers, we work on our own, and it's quite rare to have a co-writer in any case. But in terms of that situation, it's rare to have someone who's actually particularly interested in what's being written.
I mean, the scandal that blew up on the eve of the Rio Olympics with the missed drugs test and the possibility of a ban sort of hanging over her head. I guess what surprised people about that was this impression that we had of her being very in control, and from that you imagine that she's very well organised. And what came out from that was that she perhaps wasn't. Is that
yeah,
perhaps
accurate? I think it's fair to say. But I think the point is that one of the things that we said at the very start of the process, and interestingly, the original introduction for the book was about how there is this disconnect between how we perceive athletes, particularly those with, you know, most of all those with high public profiles, and how their lives really actually are. You know, I think if you were to look at the reality of Peter Sagan's life, you'd probably find it's very different from what we see. Because that's just the nature of it. You know, what we see is mediated by the likes of you and me. You know, and I think the point is that, you know, people's lives can be chaotic. Stuff can go on in people's lives that they might not necessarily want to be made public for very good reasons and very ethical reasons. You know, and we might not know about those things, you know, and people people who have public profiles do have a right to keep those things as private as they want.
You are listening to the cycling podcast Femina, supported by Rafa, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004.
Thank you very much indeed to Rafa for sponsoring the cycling podcast Femina. They are fantastic partners for the cycling podcast and the cycling podcast Femina. Very grateful indeed to them. So we heard there from William Fotheringham, who worked with Lizzie on her book. I mean, just before we ordered our burgers here, Orla, one or two things to pick on. I mean, last year when the news came out that she was, there was a possibility of her missing Olympic Games and being banned, getting a doping suspension, we did, Lionel, Bernie, Daniel Friedman, myself, we discussed that for the cycling podcast Femina that went out just before the Olympic Games, and it was just as the news kind of broke and we didn't have all the facts at our disposal. I haven't listened to that again recently, but I think we were pretty hard on her, thinking that a professional athlete who misses three tests or has three whereabouts failures in a year has been negligent and deserves to be punished for it, and that, you know, going by the letter of the law, she deserved a 2-year suspension. Now, I'm not just, you know, in her book, she's obviously had the opportunity to put her side of things across.
I think and certainly I would temper what I said while sticking with that view that the rules need to be applied consistently or there's no point in having rules. Her case is it's interesting. And what's surprising about it for people who read the book is the line that UK anti-doping took. And I've heard this from other people as well, that the Court of Arbitration for Sport did dismiss this very quickly and threw it out and were quite critical of UK anti-doping. The reason we don't know that is because Lizzie Dagnan refused to allow the Court of Arbitration for Sport to publish the reasoned decision. Normally the reasoned decision comes out weeks or even months later. That's never been published. There is detail in the book that isn't known about the circumstances around one of the missed tests, which was when she was in Ireland and Donegal with her now husband Philip Dagnan, whose father had terminal cancer. He has since passed away. And that was a detail she didn't want in the public domain. It's out now under her own terms. In her own terms, she has released that information. But that was the reason she didn't want the reasoned decision, right? Because there was a lot of very personal stuff around that in particular that she used in her case. Now, you know, I challenge anybody to read it and not have a lot of sympathy with her for the two of those strikes, although, you know, strict liability and all that. She was at fault for one of them. It was an oversight for two of them, really. But the first one, the one that was highly contentious, where a UK anti-doping whereabouts officer our anti-doping officer didn't do all that he could to find her, clearly that should have been thrown out. And that's what the Court of Arbitration for Sport said unequivocally. So you can see why some of the stories and the headlines and the discussion that we had at the time was hard and perhaps unfairly so, if I look back on it now with hindsight.
To be honest, that's what I thought at the time. And maybe it's because I followed Lizzie's career and I'm... We never know about any athlete, do we? So I could even be naive sitting here and saying that I believed her at the time. But it wasn't even actually a question of whether I believed her or not. For me, it was that the Court of Arbitration for Sport had thrown it out. They'd thrown it out with reason. They have three judges on that panel who listen to these kinds of cases day in, day out. And they decided that the UK anti-doping officer did not do enough to try to find Lizzie. And the uproar I find about her case being overturned was so disproportionate to the fact that it was overturned. The fact that they decided that actually she should not have been suspended and that she was cleared to compete. And I find that we can be quite selective sometimes as to when we decide to believe in the rulemakers and believe in those rules, because if we look at any other incidents whereby we want a rider to be guilty, we say, well, they followed the rules, but those rules aren't strict enough. Well, in this case, she followed the rules. I mean, I find it really harsh on her at the time, and I think in the context possibly of all the Russian athletes who had been the focus of such attention, and we were saying if Lizzie had been a foreign athlete, would the British media have been harsher on her? Well, I don't see how that's relevant. For me, it's a case of she had a case to answer at the Court of Arbitration for Sport. That was answered. The Court of Arbitration for Sport took 5 hours to throw it out when it usually takes a couple of days. And I did think at that time that the negative press was unduly harsh. It has to be said that I was one of only two people to interview her in Rio when she landed, myself and Jill Douglas from the BBC. So I did see firsthand a woman who was broken, who was devastated, and that is incredibly rare as a journalist, isn't it? We tend to see a much more polished or defiant athlete in front of us, and rarely do we get to see into the vulnerabilities of an athlete. So maybe I was a bit biased, but I thought it was unduly harsh at the time, and I still think it. No, it was.
I think the problem some of us had was reconciling this athlete who seemed to be so, as we've spoken about already, in control and thoughtful and serious about her career, and she talks in her book a lot about professionalism, you know, that reconciling that impression we had of her with somebody who at the time we thought had been very, very careless and negligent. The detail that she supplies in the book, and I would say to people, do read the book, does put a different slant on it, and does, if you're willing to give her the benefit of the doubt, if your mind's open to that, then I think you will have come away from it with a slightly different view. More importantly, though, we should really order our burgers, Orla.
I am Hank Marvin.
No, but before we go, we have two signed copies of Lizzie Dagland's book to give away, Steadfast. We will give them to two lucky listeners. Need to think of a question. What can we think of? Tom will edit all this bit out. Sorry for that abrupt gear change there. I launched into my Lizzie Dagland competition without actually thinking of a question. And we've been racking our brains thinking of a question. We should wrap things up, though, so let's get the question out there and order our meal, Orla. What will the question be? You had a suggestion.
My suggestion was, how long does it take Richard Moore, a.k.a. the Buffalo, because he tends to charge on in, like with that question, how long does it take him to down a double cheeseburger with fries and a beer? But my concern was that I would probably finish my cheeseburger and fries before you did, so we didn't go with that one.
Okay, well, the question instead is, who is Lizzie Dagland's coach? And the answer is contained in the interview that we did with her last year, which went out, I think, end of February. So, you know, you can do a bit of research there. You can Google it, but that might give you the wrong answer.
Yeah.
So, who is Lizzie Armitstead's coach, Lizzie Dagland's coach? And if you could tweet your answer or send a Facebook message, put a hashtag on the tweet saying Dagnan Comp. So there's a spelling element to this as well. And we will pick two winners at random. Who coaches her?
There's a spelling element to hashtag
Dagnan Comp. Anyway, let's wrap things up for this month, Orla. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. There's a speaking element to this. Thank you.
We'll see you next month at the Women's Tour, I think.
Yeah. Can't wait for that. It's going to be a good one. More race action.
You are listening to the cycling podcast Femina, supported by Rafa, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004.